Hello and welcome to the GAK.co.uk Guitar Shop Podcast. I am your host Mark Packham, who is with me this evening.
Hello, my name's Jay, I'm the assistant manager here in the guitar store.
And I'm Joe, and I'm here for bass queries and things.
Well, Jay Cross back this evening.
Hello.
A long American jaunt.
Yes.
No Matt Knight this evening.
No.
How was your American trip?
Yeah, it was really good. I was in Philadelphia for a week. I was in Pennsylvania. I spent some time in Philadelphia and spent some time in Westchester. Went down to Florida, which was fun.
Awesome. I've never been to Philadelphia.
Philadelphia is ace.
Is it like Tom Hanks' Philadelphia?
No.
Or is it like Will Smith's?
That's good, yeah. I would say a little bit of both of those.
Oh, nice.
Philly is awesome. It's the only place I can imagine myself living other than Brighton, because Brighton is, Brighton is obviously the best town in the world, which is something I said a lot while I was in America, and people were like, really? I was like, dude, Brighton is the best town in the world, no question, and Philadelphia is probably second.
Mm.
It was good. I did sort of say to myself I was going to give myself a proper holiday and not look at guitars and stuff, but I couldn't do that. I went into a little guitar shop in Westchester, and it was great. They had loads of vintage.
Is there loads of like quirky stuff?
It was just loads of vintage like Fender heads and stuff
that we just don't see.
There was a 50 watt 70s Bassman. And like a super reverb and just loads of cool stuff that I want. I wanted it all, and you just can't get it. And it was really hard to transport back, so I didn't.
Get it, get a step down and use it.
It's funny, isn't it, that now everything launches day and day everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So when America get a particular Fender product, we get the same, you know, and it's easily available generally unless it's marked as a limited run because the distribution channels are so good. Whereas I guess back in the day, there would have been like a small importer who would have imported like
five
one
or something.
Just one when someone wanted.
I mean, it was just quite cool, like, because this place, they were a Fender dealer, and you know, they did a lot of the same stuff that we did. They're a Fender dealer. Did some Gibson stuff, and it was so weird to see the guitars that we've got here out of context.
Right, okay.
You know, they're not being played by someone, they're still hung up on a wall, but it's not our wall. And I'm like, oh, okay, it was great. It was, the long and short of it was really good. I missed all of the boys here, obviously.
Well, we certainly.
Which one of us did you miss the most?
Who sat in for me last week? Dan Gracie's I missed the most. There we go. That's
brilliant.
What I'm gonna, only because he's not here and probably won't listen. So, you know, I can sort of say it without massaging anyone's ego.
Well, thanks very much.
That's all right.
Brilliant.
Sort of better when you weren't here.
Yeah? Was it?
No, we miss you a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Loads of people saying they miss the sort of inane banter that you bring.
The boring one. The boring, funny one.
I thought
people were saying there seemed to be a lot more information.
They were saying a lot more kind of correct information, much more accurate.
But it was boring.
Well, some people
mundane.
Said much more entertaining.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm the fun one.
Now, talking about kind of old gear and...
Wait. Oh, sorry. I thought you referred to me.
Yeah, just old gear. Just a bit of old gear. That's what you are. Old gill. That's what you are. So talking about old gear and the kind of scarcity of it back in the day and how things became iconic. Tonight, for the kind of meat of the podcast, we are going to talk about guitars of the decade. Now, not in a kind of well done for winning a prize, you were the best guitar of the decade, but more the kind of guitars that stood out from the 50s
evolution.
Yeah, from the 50s through to the 90s. I thought we'd just have a little chat around what was available, how you could kind of get a similar sound to that these days, and how those guitars and those playing styles have kind of progressed, really.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose a sort of broad overview of the essential sounds, because of course each decade will have loads and loads of different styles within it, but just the most iconic.
Yeah, the kind of the guitars that sum up the particular decade. Mm. So let's start at the start. The 1950s. Obviously, you know, There was a few guitars around before that. But when you think of kind of modern pop rock music, I guess 50s is the decade that you associate with that. And the first kind of guitar that I pulled out really was kind of maple neck Strats. Not Tellys. Although
why Strats?
Well, I was tempted to put Tellys.
Well, because yeah, absolutely. I mean, that kind of makes more sense.
The start of the 50s is you know, as the birth of the Telecaster.
Yeah, the birth of the solid body electric guitar.
That is true. And
the P-bass.
That's true, obviously, and they kind of kick-started the thing. But I think when I think of 50s and I think of an electric guitar, I think of, you know, like Buddy Holly playing a maple neck Strat, that real kind of rock and roll tone. And it could be argued that the Tele is the one to go for. But think about like this. The Strat was seen as the kind of... It was seen as an upgrade to the Tele.
Right.
It was like Leo Fender's next design. So I think when you think of the kind of like... Billboard artists, you know, like the big hitters who would have had enough money to buy a guitar at that time, they would have been looking at the Strat because it was like the deluxe model, essentially.
I think, but this is quite interesting. I'm sure we've probably mentioned this before, but I know that there's a lot of people who've started listening to the podcast, you know, over the last sort of few weeks and months and stuff, and perhaps don't know this. The Telecaster.
I already know where this is dropping. What? No, carry on.
No, I'm just going to say, like, the history. I mean, if we're talking about sort of guitars of the decade, and we're talking about interesting points about that, I think that the story of the Telecaster is quite interesting. You know, so the first prototypes were what, 49?
No casters.
Well, the no caster. Well,
broadcaster,
which is what I was going to say. The broadcaster prototype was, I think, 49.
Yeah, when you see 49. those snake heads,
and they had no truss rod, and it was just it was very, very strange. And then the first sort of real recognisable spec correct, I guess, is, you know, if that's what you want to refer to it in terms of today's terms. Came around in 51, so the 51 51 broadcaster. But Fender got sued by Gretsch, who had a drum kit called the Broadcaster, and so Leo went, oh, okay, well, I can't, this guitar, I wanted to call it the Broadcaster, I can't call it the Broadcaster, well, I'll just call it, it won't be called anything, it's just a Fender guitar. And so people started referring to it as the No-Caster, because it wasn't a Broadcaster, it was just a No-Caster. And then when it came time to actually having a name, in 52, he went, well, I want it to be modern, I want it to be cool, I want it to be cutting edge. What's modern and cool and cutting edge in 1952? The television's modern, and so it became the Telecaster. And I think that's quite a neat little story. And of course the funny side of that now is that Gretsch are owned by Fender. And so I'm sure Leo Fender got the last laugh in that situation.
Gretsch still make a Broadcaster bass, but with a K.
It was named after the drum kit, though.
That was where the kind of conflict was back in the day. But they still make products under the Broadcaster name. It's the hollow-bodied bass.
The double cutaway. When did the Esquire hit the ground?
I'm always confused by this in the timeline.
Yeah, because essentially it is maybe a no-caster.
The Esquire was I'm sure the Esquire was 51.
Mm.
I'm sure the Esquire was 51, and then...
So it was brought out as an alternative?
Well, I guess so.
Maybe a slightly more niche one?
I don't really know.
I guess we should talk about this if we don't know about
I mean, I've definitely read on it in the past, but there's... I've read a lot of stuff in the past that I can't remember. I'll do some research into this. I'm sure there's people screaming at their iPod headphones that they know what's going on and that we're idiots. But I can't remember the timeline. I mean, but the Esquire, I'm sure the Esquire first came about in 51, at the, you know, as well as the No-Caster.
Same thing as we're talking about, kind of, you know, the nice story about the Telecaster and how it came about and sort of that progression of it through the 50s. The precision bass kind of ran along alongside both the Telecaster and the Stratocaster, because of course we didn't have the jazz bass until 1960. So there was just that one bass that was kind of the equivalent for the Telecaster and the Stratocaster.
What's the timeline for the Fender basses? Because there was the originally there was what we now call the telly bass.
Well, the telly, yeah.
But that was the P bass, is that right?
Not quite. Okay. Not quite. It's a little muddy because Fender, as usual, can never work out what they're going to name something and just call things different things. But yeah, the P bass turned up at first in 51 with kind of just a straight single coil bang in the middle of the body. Its control plate was the same as a Telecaster, so sort of metal and mounted rather than being part of the scratch plate as it is now. And that was kind of, that was your 51 Precision bass, the first one. Had a Tele style headstock as well, and that evolved, and then in 56 it got a big facelift, and they changed it to kind of what we essentially know it as today,
right?
With the split hum cancelling pickup and the controls mounted into the now bigger scratch plate. It got its new headstock. I mean, in between that, you did get the 54P basses, where they'd start to think about like contours and things like that to make it less of a slab body, so that it was more playable. But I suppose the first real facelift was 56, where it became what it is today. And it was brought around, that big facelift was to bring it in line with the Stratocaster.
Right, okay.
So the P bass has been both guitars,
the telly, and right, okay.
And what you're talking about what the telly bass is now, they re-released the original spec Precision bass with its single coil in the middle of the body, exactly as it was in 51, in the 60s, and called it a telly bass because, of course, they had the Precision bass. Then, after like 3 years of running it like that, they changed it. I think it ran to 63. As the original Precision shape, but called a Tele bass, and then in 63 they changed it to the wide range bass humbucker, which we now see on the Starcaster and the modern player Tele bass. They moved that right to the neck position and gave it a new scratch
really
plate,
really thuddy then.
Yeah, exactly. And they called, and then that was the Tele bass,
which is quite weird, because I mean, you know, if that's what is sort of considered the iconic sound of the Tele bass, I mean, that's so far tonally from what you'd consider the iconic sound of the Telecaster guitar, you know, because you think Tele, you think country, think abrasive and raucous, and you know, if you're going the complete, you know, you think bridge pickup, you think bridge and brass saddle, so it's really, really bright.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you're going all the way to the other end of the spectrum, it's just an interesting
that it has the same name but has virtually nothing in
common. I mean, I guess it's more to do with the body shape.
I guess that's you know, that sort of throws our usual, it's not about what it looks like, it's about what it sounds like and what it plays like. That's sort of our usual thing, whereas in this case it's just what it looks like. It looks like a telly.
That's why they called that.
You don't see many telly basses these days. The only band I can think of that used one is The Hives, or used one in the past.
I tend to think that for modern rock and pop music, that pickup in that position just doesn't work, because it doesn't cut through the mix.
Billy Sheehan has one in that position.
He does, but he's also got 10 other pickups. Well, he has
it in conjunction with the
P bass pickup. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it just doesn't cut through enough. Mm. Where that worked really well, I guess in the 70s, there was a bit of a kind of like reggae and dub kind of revival, and having that big thuddy pickup in the neck really worked at that point. And also players were using things like SG basses towards the end of the 60s.
And Cream sort of really bringing home that like flat wound, that SG bass sound with the big pickup.
Exactly, and that's where the telly works. Anyway, we're a little off topic, because we're talking about the 70s already, but the 50s, like I said, I picked out the Maple Neck Strat, because when I think of kind of rock and roll players, and I think of like Buddy Holly, that's what kind of defines that 50s sound, that jangly...
I'm not disagreeing in this, like, I mainly just brought up the Telecaster just to sort of...
Because I wanted
to wind you up more than anything, but no, I mean, in all seriousness, when I think of 50s guitars, I tend to think of Hank Marvin.
Yep.
You know, it's that's pretty right.
It's something that we talk about every single day, and that I think is another really interesting sort of break point, and not maturity point, but sort of evolution of the Strat. You know, the 56 spec Strat is, you know, big chunky neck, I think it's the V. Is it the V-shaped profile as well?
Yeah,
I think
that's on the 56.
On the 56, and I think that's really. It's very different to what you think of today. You know, when you think of a Strat today, you think, you know, slim neck and five-way selector switch. Whereas 56, it's, you know, big chunky neck, three-way selector switch. You know, and I'm a big fan of the. I'm a really big fan of that 56.
What were the three-way selectors on a Strat then?
Just each pickup.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Individually.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Like you have on the original spec tellies, where you can
The tellies were. All the way in the back is the bridge pickup. Mm-hmm. Then in the middle is the neck pickup, and then the third position is the neck pickup with the tone off, because they hadn't really fully developed the concept of electric bass. Yep. So people were using that as a kind of go-to instrument. So you could have your guitar sounds, and in the third position you got a kind of more muted bass sound.
I think in one of the places I think that I first saw that and started to really appreciate that was. When I saw, you know, that film Walk the Line, that film about Johnny Cash with Joaquin Phoenix, like in there, when it was Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two, I think it was, one of them played a Telecaster and the other played a Telecaster, but just playing the bass notes, and that's where that I think was a very very like very common
tone rolled off. Yeah. You only had one guitar to go and do everything you needed to do. Yeah. But yeah, no, the three-way selector on. 50 Strats, yes, just selected pickups individually. Right. And then I forget the year that it changed.
I can't
and it's
remember.
Much later than you think. Yeah. It's like 65 or 66 or something.
Wait, really? Is it that late?
I think so. Really? It's much later.
No, because the 62s.
So Hendrix would have been.
Way.
But I think that's a modern invention, like a modern kind of rejigging.
Really?
I think so. We need to look into it.
Yeah, let's check.
Please.
So what Hendrix was playing was actually pretty state of the art.
Well, what people were doing was a lot of players were jamming matchsticks. They were finding the in-between, out-of-phase position that they liked. And then jamming matchsticks in either side of the pickup selector so that it wouldn't move. So that it was stuck in the out-of-phase position. So people were doing that kind of Mark Knopfler Dire Straits sound before you could officially do that on a Strat by just not stopping it working. By like jamming stuff in there,
and a lot of the Fender Custom Shop, you know those 50s spec stuff. A lot of it is comes in just a three way selector switch,
really?
But they do come with a five way switch in the case.
So we can
switch that out
because that comes with the Telecaster as well. The American Vintage, it comes with standard wiring, but you can hook it up.
That's right.
For the convention.
Yeah, used to a lot of the time 52. Be the other way around. It would be that you do the mod to make it a more modern telly, but these days they tend to make it so it's modern, but you can put the capacitor in to take it back to the original wiring. So I guess the other thing that I kind of would have been around or would have been much more popular, I think, at the beginning of the 50s, because, you know, these new American guitar manufacturers hadn't really, or Fender in particular, hadn't really taken off straight away, you know, were like big box jazz guitars, so maybe like Gibson style, and you know, you listen to a lot of those records and they're all played on like big jazz box guitars. Even looking at players like, I mean, I saw a picture of Chuck Berry the other day. A lot of his stuff, actually, you know, you'd think like, oh, it's 335. A lot of his really early stuff wasn't. It was on a much bigger kind of jazz style guitar because that's what was available.
So what was that? Would that be a 137 or a 175?
Do you know what? I couldn't actually name the one that he had in the picture off the top of my head, but yeah, it was like a bigger body P90 sort of jazz style. And I think that really kind of defines a lot of those records, really. The sound isn't particularly jangly. It's that real jazz box kind of honky type sound. And that, it progressed a little bit more when people were moving on to 335s. But yeah, that I do think was a big component of that. What guitars are kind of out there now if people are looking for that kind of sound? What would be your kind of go-to if someone wants that kind of 50s jazz box style guitar?
Well, I mean, I don't think any of those guitars have ever... Well, in terms of the sort of the modern era, I don't think any of them are officially unavailable. You know, I don't think that any of them are sort of out of the catalogue. It's just Gibson just don't make very many of them, you know, because it's not a case of sort of supply and demand really. It's a case of logistics. You know, they've only got all of the hollow body stuff by Gibson is in the Memphis factory, and you know that's where they make all of the acoustics as well, and it's not very big. Now, you know, I know Matt's not here, so I can sort of talk about it a bit more freely. He always gets a bit annoyed when I say a couple of years ago I went to the Gibson Custom Shop factory when it was still in Nashville. I mean, the electric side of things is still in Nashville, but at the time they were producing everything there, all of the electrics, all the 335s and 339s and everything. And I also went to the USA factory. And when I went into the USA factory, one of the things they said is that, you know, they finish 600 roughly guitars a day. So that's, you know, your Les Paul standards, Les Paul traditional, studios, juniors, all of those, and all the SGs and all the you know, the Flying V's and everything like that. And then the custom shop, so where all of the hollow bodies are made, they only finish something like 13, 12, you know, it's hardly any guitars a day. And so it just comes down to the fact that most of the time people who want a 335, people who want a hollow body want a 335 or a 339.
Yeah.
And so that's what they produce most of. Every now and again, we'll get through a 137, or we'll get through a 175, or we'll get through a 390, or we'll get through a 355. You know, and it's all of those. I don't think there's any one thing that you can go, right, if you want that early 50 sound, this is the guitar for you. Because also, you know, there's so many of those.
Definitely.
Of those, you know, 175, 195, you know, there's and yeah, but all of those things are still available. The one, my personal favourite is probably the 137. I really like the 137.
Do you know the guitar that I would actually pick out? Because they're not huge money, the build quality is really good, and I think they're as authentic as they come. Epiphone Joe Pass.
Great guitar. I actually plugged one of those in yesterday. And I tell you, the thing that surprised me the most is how raucous the neck pickup is. It's a lot more gritty than I think you expect it to. It's a lot grittier than you sort of your neck position on a 335, for example, or even on a Les Paul. It's really like that it's really abrasive, really growly. I thought that guitar sounded absolutely excellent.
We shouldn't exclude Gretsch from this, and actually also I think, you know, if we're just talking about getting the sound, Ibanez with their Art Core series.
The AF stuff is great. I mean, we spoke about that a few weeks ago, didn't we? I think one of my staff pick was the AF, I think it's the 195, I think it was. Again, I'm useless with the numbers. But some of the Ibanez stuff is excellent. It's seriously excellent.
Good that you bring up Gretsch there, because actually I think that kind of takes us across into the next decade. Now, Gretsch obviously, you know, produced great guitars in the 50s, and if you know think about the kind of rockabilly and early rock and roll, their hollow bodies really kind of defined that sound, alongside, you know, things like those jazz box guitars and the kind of 50s Strats. Those are the three I think that I would actually pick out as being kind of rock and roll guitars,
right?
Yeah.
But I guess they had a kind of a big boom when the Beatles arrived. George Harrison playing, you know, Country Gents, and the duo Jet, I think, was the other big Harrison guitar.
That was his other one, yeah.
And for me, I mean, that's what kind of kickstarted a kind of guitar revolution almost in the 60s, in that, you know, kids saw the Beatles up there and wanted to play and wanted to have those guitars. And really, that's where I think the kind of industry that we work in.
I think the Beatles, and I mean, this may be sort of a bit of a cop out thing to say, but I think the Beatles have got. I think we modern music really owes so much more to the Beatles than anybody lets on. You know, it's not just the way that song structure changed. It's not just the way that vocal melodies changed. It's not just the way that, you know, the sort of the idea of the pop star changed. You know, like you say, they made guitars sort of accessible and cool and different. And, you know, you think about the other sort of big acts at the time, everyone's using Fender or Gibson, everyone. And they come along using, like you say, Gretsch and John's Ricky's.
Well, this is it. I've always thought it's weird that the most iconic band in the world's bass player plays one of the least used basses.
The next thing I was going to say, was Paul's, viola bass. You know, I mean, I really do think that the, you know, and I mean, you're Mark, you're the big Beatles head here. I mean, I like the Beatles. I've never been crazy over them, but I really do think we owe far more to those four fellas than we realise.
Well, I mean, definitely, I would say for us on the guitar front, because they, like you say, they kind of built up that idea of the pop star, but also the kind of celebrity endorsement almost. You know, there were kind of signature models and iconic players before them, Les Paul obviously being one of them, with probably the first signature model electric guitar.
Well, I mean, it must be.
I think we argued that before, didn't we?
Yeah, I think it is.
It must be. He must be the first.
I think so. But, you know, the Beatles were out there kind of proudly displaying these, and, you know, they had their deal with Vox that meant they'd only ever play Vox amplifiers as long as the manager was alive. And, you know, that took their company, the Vox company, from being almost a kind of small homebrew company up to being one of the biggest amp manufacturers in the world.
And that in itself, sorry, I don't mean to interject, but that in itself, I think, is another thing which is sort of, Vox absolutely have a huge debt to the Beatles, you know, because if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, if I'm not mistaken, before they signed that deal, they were using Selmers.
They were using a combination of Selma stuff and also
some Fender bits, wasn't it? George was using Fender amps pre-Vox.
Yes, they had like a 57 Deluxe or 57 Twin.
Told me that.
But yeah, but also they had like weird homemade stuff too. Like a local Liverpool company were building these bass rigs for Paul and building 218 sweet coffins and stuff like that.
Oh god.
But yeah, I mean, it really. That kind of decade saw the beginning of kind of mass manufacture and affordable instruments, and like we're saying, like the big brands. And yeah, certainly with the Beatles, obviously Rickenbacker, John's kind of iconic, the 325, the small body three pickup. That's the right code, right? 325?
I think so. I think so.
Which had that weird little trim that he then
sort of didn't really do very much.
Doesn't really do much, but he actually replaced it for a Bigsby fairly early on.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
And Gretsch, you know, with George playing the country jet and the duo jet.
Yeah.
So if you were looking at those guitars today, I mean, I guess the other thing
about
those,
available.
Well, those two That's, companies, everything's you can still buy the same guitars.
Everything's still. I mean, the John Lennon. I'm sure it's the 325. I'm pretty sure it's the 325. That is. I mean, we had one of those not long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to talk about scarcity in the guitar world. I mean, Rickenbacker is your number one culprit.
They are basically the same company.
Yeah, that they were in the 60s.
Still family owned. They still
produce in California.
Yeah, they haven't really expanded their facilities at all. So they're still building on the same kind of spec machines, as far as I'm aware, as they were in the 60s. I mean, if you're buying a 330 or 360 or a 325
or 620,
they're going to be
personal favorite.
Very very similar to the guitars played by the Beatles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I whilst we're on actually the subject of Rickenbacker, I'm going to slightly steer this
don't derail the podcast.
I won't completely derail it, but just on a slight aside, my girlfriend now works with a guy who listens to this podcast who used to make Rickenbackers in the Rickenbacker factory.
Really?
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Exactly. And she got a little Facebook message from him a couple of days ago saying, you need to tell Joe that I'm at the I think it's the LA Bass Convention, because that was a couple of days ago, sitting with Billy Sheehan. And I was like, messaging back, tell him about the podcast. So he did.
Really?
He told Billy Sheehan about the podcast. So
Billy Sheehan,
hope you're listening.
Oh, that'd be the dream.
Where
Joe's a big fan, Billy. If ever you want to come to Brighton, Joe will
at Yosef,
show you around.
At Yosef underscore 900, Billy, if you are listening, that would be hilarious. That would make my day. Anyway, so Rickenbacker built, you know, very similar to how they were. And, you know, Gretsch have gone through a few changes. They're now, their main bulk of their guitars are built in Japan. They're now owned by Fender.
Yep.
But the quality is still very high. And absolutely, to be honest, the quality of the Japanese guitars, I would say, is actually a lot higher than they were coming out of America pre the time that Fender bought them.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, and I know, again, we've spoken about this a few times, the Gretsch Electromatics, you know, you're looking at 600 quid, 700 quid for some, just absolutely, I mean, I have one, I've spoken about it a load. I thought mine was absolutely great. I loved it.
What was it?
It was a 5125. If I remember correctly, it had the Diamond single coil, so it's slightly different to the spec that's around now, the sort of the common one, which is the 5420 or the 5422 if you want to get the double cut, which I think looks absolutely ace as well. But I mean, you know, they are mainly Korean, I think, Korean or Indonesian, I think Korean. I mean, Korea has always produced great, you know, budget, again, sort of quote unquote budget guitars. And yeah, the Gretsch stuff is absolutely excellent.
Yeah, actually, speaking of Korea, I suppose we're starting to see all the old kind of late 80s, early 90s Korean Squires start to sort of
creep up in value.
A lot, because they are very good.
Hey, great guitars.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a Korean made Squire Telly.
That's a great Telly, that one. Yeah, really, really.
I used to own a Candy Apple Korean Strat. With the maple neck, it's probably the best Strat I've ever owned.
Really? Wow.
It's absolutely wicked.
Is it the only Strat you've ever owned?
No, I've still got a Honer Arbor.
Oh, okay, fine, okay.
MXC11.
I don't say that because I was casting aspersions on the quality. I just say that because I didn't really see you, as I didn't know you had Strats. So,
so alongside the Gretsch and Rickenbacker stuff, again, one final guitar, or in fact two guitars that I guess used by the Beatles that became kind of synonymous with the 60s. Firstly, the Rosewood Neck Strat. Mm-hmm. Beatles had some mid-60s Rosewood Neck Strats that were used. That is the sound of Rubber Soul and Revolver, basically.
The blue ones.
Blue ones, yeah. Definitely blue, the matching headstock. Yeah. That's kind of the sound of Rubber Soul. They'd moved on to Casinos by Revolver. But also, the SG. So, the SG, I guess, came about early 60s when Les Paul wanted a new signature model, wanted something a bit lighter, a bit thinner. And then, so the original SG 61, I believe, came out with Les Paul on the headstock.
Yep.
And then he went, I'm not so into these. They don't really suit my playing style. I'm not a big fan. But everyone at Gibson really still liked the design, and they'd proved quite popular. So they changed the name to SG for solid guitar. And they've been in the catalogue ever since, the SG standard, I guess. And again, Beatles used those to full effect. George Harrison, you wouldn't think of him as an SG player. But they became the kind of, again, his guitar through the mid-60s, right through the White Album and onto the end, really.
Really? I didn't know that. I didn't know it was...
Yeah, you wouldn't think that he was kind of... That was the guitar he used. But if you look at a lot of the footage, he's either playing... Like, after he ditches the Gretsch and... John ditches the Rickenbacker. They're both of them.
When did the Rosewood Telly come into play?
Rosewood Telly, right at the end.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I knew he was playing it on the rooftop.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was just that late, though.
I suppose that's one thing to mention, as we're kind of still on the 60s. The 60s would be the birth of Fender using Rosewood. Well.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And I mentioned that, you know, in the Rosewood Strats, but you're right. When you start getting Rosewood neck P basses, start getting Rosewood neck, like the jazz bass.
They were exclusively maple before that for the whole of the 50s.
Yeah, yeah. Did you want to speak a little bit about the birth of the jazz?
I suppose so. I mean, the jazz came about, I mean, really, if I'm going to talk about the birth of the jazz, it kind of goes hand in hand with a pair of guitars that obviously weren't necessarily synonymous with the 60s, but certainly were when Fender introduced them. The Fender's introduction of their premium range, which was the Jazz Master
and the Jaguar,
and the Jazz Bass was the bass equivalent of those. So it's offset in shape. A lot of people think the Jazz Bass is the equivalent of the Strat, but it wasn't. It's very much the equivalent of the Jaguar or Jazz Master. So offset body, a pair of single coil pickups. I actually really like the story behind the Jazz Bass, because Leo Fender went to bass players at the time, who of course are all playing P basses more or less if they're playing Fender, and he asked them what they didn't like about the P bass or what they'd improve. So rather than it being...
Well, they should have come to me and I would have said absolutely nothing. What were you playing at? Why would you need to build anything else? This is the best bass of all time.
Well, of course, yes. But
can you do it in a slightly weird red?
Yeah, that's what I would want. I'd just say...
Mark has a slightly weird
if you
red.
If you could make this in Sunset Orange Transparent...
There we go, Sunset Orange Transparent.
We're laughing. No one will ever need to buy another bass ever again.
Well, there we go. But anyway, Leo Fender didn't go to you. He went to bass players of the time and he said, what don't you like? What can make this more playable? And the bass players of the time said, well, the neck is a touch chunky. It could have a bit more of a taper so we could actually get our hands around the damn thing. That would be ideal. And it would be great to have some tonal options, really. Guitarists get lots of pickups in their guitars. We've got one in ours. So he came up with a couple of single coils, one in the bridge, one in the mid position, that you get very, very different sounds from, and gave them two separate volume controls, and originally two separate tone controls as well, to kind of give the absolute maximum amount of shaping. The body became offset, slightly bigger, so you know, it would have more sustain, more of that woody sort of tone, and he added, you know, a handful more contours, so it sort of sat into the body a little bit better. But yeah, that was the birth of the jazz bass. And
kind of went on, I guess, to... I don't know. I don't... Personally, I think they've never been as popular as the P-Bass. I think the P-Bass has always been the go-to bass. I mean, the figures probably will argue that. I would probably be proven wrong.
I have to admit, I think I see more jazz basses than P-Basses. But I think it depends where you look. I think if you want to look on Bass Chat, you'll see more jazz basses on there, more people talking about jazz basses than the real P basses. But I think jazz bass dominates a different area to P bass. I think rock bass players play P basses. Yeah. I know very, very few fiddly session players that use P basses. It's all
just
all about jazz.
They're not nuanced enough, perhaps.
Well, but yeah, because a P bass sounds like a P bass. What I love about a P bass is it sounds great in any style on any record, just as it is.
Yeah.
What the jazz bass offers is the ability to do a few things a little differently. Also, that kind of that extra playability in the neck lends itself to kind of advanced styles and things like that. It's just a yeah, I suppose it's that's where it breaks down. I think you get players, session-y guys, would always love jazz basses.
Yeah, go for a bit more versatility and perhaps a little, like you say, a bit easier to play.
Exactly. I mean, if you were going to do it, I think you can do rock bass players versus session-y bass players based on strap height.
Yes, and, 100%.
And if you think about the precision bass and the jazz bass, how many P basses do you see around someone's ankles?
Well,
on
no,
a strap,
because that's
how
you should play them.
How many jazz basses do you see tucked under an armpit?
Yes, that's... I agree.
I sort of feel as I'm... Yeah, I've got clowns to the left, me and Joker to the right here. Like, yeah, I've got what I've got. I've got the...
I'm a rock bass player. I play flat-bound strings.
You play your jazz bass up by your chin, and Mark plays his P bass down by his ankles.
It's true. I have a Yamaha BB, which is the best of both worlds, and actually, I let you in on a little secret, I only use the P pickup.
Oh, there we go. I just as another thing before we move on to the 70s, I sort of feel as though this is an easy way for me to sort of segue in to what I just bought today.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say again is another kind of characteristic of the 60s.
Yeah,
is that a lot of manufacturers, because of the way that these instruments were kind of exploding and because of the right take up in electric, you know, electric guitars in general and kind of rock, you know, rock and roll and rock music, as it was becoming known, manufacturers started doing slightly more budget instruments.
Yeah.
And, you know, alongside the premium line, they also introduced things like...
The Mustang.
Yes.
Now, the reason that I sort of crowbarred this in is that today I bought a 65 reissue Mustang.
Very nice.
Which is the Japanese model. It's one of the only... Japanese models that's still currently available, you know, through the official Fender channels.
Yeah, they also still do the Mustang bass.
They
the
do,
official,
yeah. But we're talking about my guitar.
Yeah,
for
right,
three, yeah. No, so anyway, I bought I got a 65 reissue Mustang. Now, I did a bit of reading on this today, actually, because I finally got around to buying it. I hadn't realised just how early the Music Masters and Duosonics were available from. Because the Mustang, the 65 Mustang is, well, 65 was the first year, more or less, that the Mustang was available. And it was sort of a redesign and a reintroduction of two earlier models, which Fender were doing at the time, which was the Music Master, which was a single pickup. You had a Music Master for a while, didn't you?
I did, yeah. So
single pickup in the neck.
Yeah, single pickup in the neck. The one I had, someone had modded it to put a, I had a 64.
Okay.
Yeah, it should be single pickup in the neck, but someone had put one in the bridge as well. So
it's more like a Duosonic.
Yeah.
And then the Duosonic was, again, like a short scale twin pickup. Twin single coil, but they were available. They were both available from 56. Now I didn't realise it was that early.
Neither did I.
Yeah, I mean that's really, really early.
Yeah,
that these guitars are available from. But you know, it was the student range. I guess they probably weren't pushing them because, well, they wanted you to spend the money and buy a Strat or a Tele. You know, really, or even a Jazzmaster or a Jaguar, which were all also available at the time. But yeah, the 65. I love short scale instruments. I had a Jaguar for a while, and I was loath to get rid of it. And I'm really, really glad that I was able to pick this up. It comes in my favourite finish of Olympic White. Hey. So it matches my Olympic White Tele and my Olympic White American Standard P-Bass. So, yeah.
What colour's your Les Paul?
My Les Paul is like a natural... I can't remember the exact name. It's not Olympic White. Maybe I should get it refinned. No, I'm not going to do that. Don't worry. But yeah, like I just think it's. I really like the Mustang. I've always really liked the Mustang. I think that short scale instruments are cool. They're different. They're jangly and abrasive sounding, kind of like me. and yeah, I think it's really cool and sort of an often people sort of gloss over them because they think, oh, it's for, you know, indie idiots.
That's how I would describe it.
Which is, yeah, so I guess it's fine. Kind of, yeah, yeah. But yeah, no, I think they're great guitars. Great, great guitars. Yeah, 65.
Gents, I'm just looking at the time. I think we should maybe do the 60s, do the 70s, 80s and 90s in another podcast. So maybe
really?
Do that next week.
Have we gone on a really long time?
We've been going quite a while, but there's a lot of guitars to squeeze into the 50s and 60s because that's when most of the iconic guitars were
first
introduced.
We haven't really spoken much about the Les Paul, but I suppose the Les Paul is really going to come into its own...
When was the Les Paul discontinued?
Early 60s.
Right, okay.
I suppose it only ran for that brief period in the 50s, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, the first, you know, 54 onwards. I think they didn't really find prominence with players until the mid 60s. And really, you know, you associate them, I associate them more with that kind of like. That Eric Clapton-y wave of blues,
right.
Into the kind of, you know, Jimmy Page, like really late 60s, early 70s. So I think we should lump those in with the 70s and we can go into kind of Les Pauls in detail, maybe spanning a few decades next week.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah,
we'll pick this up again next week. Should we do some staff picks?
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Jay Cross, what have you been playing this week?
Well, I've been away. Did I mention that?
Yes.
Did I mention I've been away?
You did.
Really?
Oh, okay. Yeah. But yeah. But anyway, I've been away, and so my staff pick is a little bit difficult. It was a little bit difficult this week because I've not really had a chance to play anything because I came back to 300 emails that I had to get through. I was going through my emails at the time, but I was sort of giving them a tertiary. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. My staff pick is. A little bit different to what I'd normally go for, but I think it's quite apt. I am pretty clueless.
I agree.
When it comes to sort of technology, but one thing that I've really been getting into recently is playing music again. Is instead of just like sitting at work, sitting here and being like, oh yeah, this is guitar. I know all the specs about it. Yeah, I've been going home and I've been actually playing guitar and really enjoying it and wanting to start writing music again. And to do that, I picked up an interface this week.
Which you now have in your hands.
Which I've now got on my hands because I've not actually taken it home yet. And it's the Focusrite Sapphire Scarlett 2i2, I think.
Is that two?
It's not a sapphire, is it? I think they're either sapphire or scarlet.
Oh yeah, this is the scarlet 2i2, and it's excellent. It's great. It's super easy, super like it's for the idiot. It's for an idiot. Which is me.
Yeah, I mean, it's found its
right
place.
So are those
right
combi
place.
Sockets in the
yeah,
front there?
Yeah, they are.
So
yeah,
you can run them on jack
You've got two combi sockets in the front, so you can take two XLRs or two jacks. Basically, they're like 140 quid or something. It's brilliant. It's really, really simple, really high quality, idiot's audio interface.
So you're going to be running this into a laptop, I assume. Do you know what software you're going to be using?
I'll probably use Cakewalk.
Cakewalk's in... Is it?
No, I think Pro Tools comes with it. I think there's like a light version of... To be honest with you, I literally have picked this up today. And I spoke to the guys in our Pro Audio store who know way more about this than I do. And I basically just went in and went, look, I want the idiot's version of an audio interface.
It comes with Ableton Live.
Oh, it comes with Ableton.
Not Pro Tools in any form.
Excellent. Okay, well, it comes with Ableton, which is probably even...
Please
note,
listeners, if you are buying the 2i2, it does not come with Pro Tools.
Yes. Ableton will be perfect for you because it's pretty intuitive.
Great.
And you'll be able to get tracks down very, very easily.
That's what I want.
And it's got a pretty low spec, so your terrible old laptop will probably run it.
And the Ableton rep lives in Brighton, so you can just call him.
Just call him. Just go around his house. I'm sure he'd really appreciate that.
Okay, cool.
Do you know what I really like about these? As someone who does kind of a bit of field recording and is out and about occasionally in situations where I do laptop recording, and I just need a really simple interface that's, you know, two in. These are actually super rugged.
Yeah.
A lot of the interfaces will be plastic chassis. These are a kind of brushed aluminium chassis, I guess.
Yeah.
And
in a sexual blood red.
Indeed. And you could just kind of pop that in your laptop bag, or you could put it in your backpack with your laptop, and you could easily take this out and record straight into your DAW without any issues, really. You know, like, that will definitely stand up to a bit of a beating.
When I drop it,
yes,
it will be okay.
You will probably not break it.
Excellent, that's what I want. So there we go. If like me, you are an idiot who drops stuff and wants to record at home, the Scarlett 2i2 is the thing to go for. And I will use it this week, and I will report back next week.
I want to know what happens with your recording adventures and how long it takes you to set it up.
It will take me as long as it takes me to convince you to come round to install it for me. Yeah.
Very good. Joe Branton, what have you been playing this week?
I've just noticed that this is probably going to be the first time ever that none of our staff picks have included a guitar.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
None of the guitars.
Yeah. Okay, mine is basically, this week, I've started getting really into phasers.
Okay.
So much so that my clean sound now has a phaser on it.
That doesn't make any sense. It's not clean.
No. Well, my most basic sound... My sound before I put all the drives and synth drives on it and stuff has a phaser on it.
Wait, so you put the phaser at the front?
No, it's not at the front.
It's just constantly on.
But it's always on. No, it's after. It's in my modulation bit of the pedalboard.
Okay. Why would you do this?
Because it sounds awesome. And I was watching... Jay from Boss's video with Omar Rodriguez Lopez, the one that he filmed down here in Brighton that I went down to and got Omar to sign the guitar.
Oh yeah.
And Omar talks about, you know, how he just always leaves his phaser on, and I was like, I'm just gonna always leave my phaser on.
Okay, I think this is quite interesting, and this is something that I've sort of been looking at a little bit this week. While I was playing just before I committed and bought the Mustang, I plugged it into just because it was there, one of the Vox AC15s. And the cool thing with the AC15 is it's got reverb, and it's also got a really, really nice tremolo sound. Now, tremolo isn't really something that I'd use very often, but I turned it up just a little way, so a little bit of depth and a little bit of speed, so really slow and only a little bit. And if you ring out chords, I just think that adds just a little bit of depth and makes it a little bit more interesting. And I assume that's kind of what you're looking for.
It's very, very light.
Very subtle.
It's slow and it's light.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's really, really cool, especially if you're from a guitarist's point of view, if you're doing like big open chordy stuff. you know, if you have that sort of slight swelling going on, I just think it sounds really nice.
Yeah, I'm trying not to make it too 80s, but it's just like that. Anyway, so I was looking for a phaser to use for my sound, and I was thinking Electro Harmonics, they do that big ridiculous one.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe something like that. I was thinking I definitely need something stereo because I've got an M5 and that's got loads of phasers on it, but I've got that assigned to something else, so I knew I wouldn't be able to use it in my setup. And I was like, well, the phasers I like on the M5 are all the nuts ones. So I'm like, I'm going to need something really big, something with like multi phasers.
Yeah, something rack.
Yeah.
You want a rack phaser.
Well, something ridiculous. And then I stumbled across and thought, well, this isn't going to be enough because this would be too basic. Because they are the quintessential of everything.
Yep.
The Boss phase shifter, the PS3. And I thought, well, it will just be too general. But actually, it's wicked and has loads of depth on it. And kind of did everything for me that I was going to use this ridiculously elaborate Electro Harmonics pedal for. And then I realised that they're only £99.
Yeah. Well, isn't this sort of typical of our day-to-day struggle with Boss, which is they're just really good. Like, they're just unassumingly good constantly. And you go, oh, I don't really want another Boss pedal because I want something more interesting, I want something more fun. And you plug it in and you go, this is really interesting, this is really fun.
Yeah.
You know, it always comes back. It always comes back to Boss. It really does. No matter how much you try, it still almost always comes back to Boss. Yeah. And I'm absolutely not surprised in the slightest that you've gone for that, because I think it's a great pedal.
No, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, just loads of voicings.
And I hate saying stuff like this because Jay from Boss listens to the podcast every week.
He thinks.
We're, and I know that he's sitting in his car driving somewhere, smiling.
He owes us a lot of free lunches.
Yeah, well,
he's coming down in a couple of weeks.
Oh, there we go.
His band and my band are playing a gig at Brighton Electric.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm busy and or ill.
Yeah, busy and or ill.
Sorry, man.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. Thanks for your support.
But yeah, no, it's just really good. Yeah. It's just really good.
What, so you're just using it very lightly and on a slow speed just to thicken things up. So you're almost using it like a chorus, to be honest.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Yeah, I suppose I am. But they're just a little bit less 80s than a chorus.
I know what you mean. They haven't got that kind of, like, as you'd expect, the choral effect. It just thickens things out.
It's got that sort of
phasey effect. Yeah.
And I completely agree with Jay. If you're ever ringing out a note for a long period of time, unlike a chorus, which would, you know, it would just sound like I was ringing out a long note with chorus on it, the phasers changing that, so it just gives a little bit of character because there's some evolution in that note as it rings out. So yeah, absolutely wicked. Strongly recommended. £99. You can't go wrong.
No, just go and it'll never break.
Now, gents, I've got a bit of a news flash. The Fender Blues Junior is no longer my favourite small amp that we do.
Oh my good lord!
Yeah. I know where you're going with this, I haven't plugged it in yet, but I'm not sure I'm going to disagree.
My favourite small new amp that we do is the Fender 68 Princeton.
It's not going to be around long enough.
It looks so good.
The 68 Princeton, for those not in the know, is a reissue of a 68 Princeton, believe it or not. it was when Fender changed from what they call the blackface amps, so where they've got a black panel across the front, to silver face, so they've got a mirrored kind of silvery panel, blue text on there. I think the change in sound can be described as going from mellow on the kind of 65 stuff, you know, mellow, still Fendery bright but kind of richer sounding, to the 68, or you know, the 70 stuff as you would think of it, really the silver face stuff, mm-hmm. as being raucous. A bit more, it's just a bit more vibey. It's definitely nowhere near as mellow. It's nowhere near as much bass end. It sounds so good. This new 68, I've always wanted to pick up a little champ.
Yeah.
Like a 60, late 60s, early 70s champ, like a silver face champ. And unfortunately, Fender aren't reissuing that, because that would be ideal for me. That would be the one I could use at home for recording. Brilliant. That, you know, be super low wattage. But they brought out the Princeton, it's the smallest one they do. It's got reverb in there. The reverb sounds so lush. And it's also got vibrato.
We have one in stock.
It's around the corner.
I'm going to have a look.
Are you going now?
I'm just going to have a look.
Hurry back.
The lights are all off.
I can't believe how good they are.
And what, 12 watts? I'm sure it's 12 watts.
Something like that. I'm just going to get up some spec.
I'm pretty sure it's 12 watts. I first heard about this because a friend of mine sent me an email. He was like, mate, when are you getting these in? I need one. And he must have seen it. They must have come onto the website that day because I didn't know anything about it. And I just went absolute banal. Like, I mean, it looks incredible. It looks absolutely incredible. I mean, I've always been a big fan of the... Joe's got it. He's brought it through.
This is wicked.
He carried it with one hand. And he's a small boy. Tiny little small boy.
Yeah, how good does that look?
I'm 5'8½".
So, spec-wise, they are... So they're a 10-inch speaker.
Yeah.
Celestion 10 in there. They call it the 1030. I assume that means 30 watts handling. Output 12 watts.
There we go. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah.
For me, absolutely perfect. And I mean, I would say actually for me for home, they're probably a bit too big. They're easily giggable at 12 watts. They just sound lush.
It looks amazing. Like,
there's no middle control.
That doesn't matter.
We don't.
I know. Really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
The best thing about it is they have switched production on these from the States, which is where they normally build their reissue stuff, to Mexico.
Which is why it's only £700.
£756.
Yeah.
So not even that much of a big jump up from something like a Hot Rod Deluxe.
Well, the Hot Rod Deluxe is a $693.
Okay.
And $693, I think. And the thing with the Hot Rod Deluxe, now I love the Hot Rod Deluxe, but it's 40 watts, man.
Yeah.
You can't use it at home. Unless you have it on one, it's too loud to use at home.
It looks
amazing. And I mean, like I say, I've not plugged it in yet, but I've always liked the Princeton range. I've always thought the Princeton range was great. And I mean, I've always liked the Silverface stuff as well. Like, I had a Silverface Twin for a while.
Yeah.
Which, again, I got rid of because it was too much.
It was too heavy and it was too loud
and it was too much. And I mean, now I've got a Silverface Bassman, which is still 135 watts. So again, it's still too loud.
Yeah.
But like, the Silverface stuff, I think, is great. And that just looks absolutely awesome. I think it sort of fits, you know, when you say it's now your new favourite small amp over the Blues Junior, I think it fits a slightly different build to the Blues Junior.
I'm not actually thinking about it.
Why do you say that?
Well, the Blues Junior is more of a sort of modern guitarist amp. You know, the Princeton is, I mean, it's clean.
Yeah.
You know, it's clean the whole way until you turn it up.
I see. I've only just... There's no gain control.
It's just master volume. Yeah, yeah. And so that I'm really into. I think that's great, especially for, you know, if you've got your pedals and stuff, then you know, it will work absolutely excellently. But I think the Blues Junior still has its place in, you know, the sort of modern guitarists.
It's much more of a utility amp,
yeah,
in that it's
absolutely
got the fat switch. You can drive it a bit. It's got reverb. Plus, you know, it's quite enough for home if you wanted it to.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think that Princeton, thinking about it, it's probably not quite enough for home. But for small gigs, man, that's blowing the Blues Junior out of the water.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think, people will say, is 12 watts enough?
Yes.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when was the last time you went anywhere and played anywhere where your amp wasn't mic'd up?
100%.
I mean, that's the thing. And, you know, you want something with a small wattage so that you can really turn it up, so that you can get all the tubes absolutely screaming. And that's what those things are so good for.
Gents.
Oh, I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, you need to plug it in. That's my staff pick for the week. Should we move on to some questions?
Yeah.
Oh, why not?
This is from Matthew via email. There was a kind of a bit of a caveat to this email saying he thought it was a bit frivolous. But let's.
Okay. I remember Matthew. I sold him this guitar.
So Matthew says, in September, I bought a Fender Cabernet Telecaster Thin Line in Shoreline Gold. Obviously the best colour.
Well,
that's what he says.
Yeah.
It looks amazing, but the white scratch plate is just a bit boring.
Yeah.
So I want to know if you had this guitar, what colour scratch plate would you guys have on this guitar, if you could have any? I'm thinking possibly a mirror plate, just to make it look even more show-offy.
Well, if we're talking about mirror plates, surely you're the man to talk to here.
I've owned two guitars that have had mirror plates.
Yeah.
Oh, this is why you made us include the Chris Atkins.
Chris Aitken.
Aitken.
Yes, when we were talking last week, because I love the mirror scratch bass. Yeah, basically, you've got a Shoreline Gold guitar. Unless you go for the white plate that's already on it, mirror. It's got to be mirror.
No, no, no. Come on, a Torque Guard would look amazing on
I'm
that.
Not sure
a tortoiseshell scratch plates work on every single
colour.
On
gold?
Colour. Yeah, think about it. At a distance, it would be like, is that Olympic white? Oh, no, it's something better.
It's gold.
Yes.
Nothing's better than Olympic white, Geese.
No, well.
I honestly think Shoreline Gold with a chrome or mirror scratch plate.
I think it will look. In fairness, I think. I mean, your P bass looked ridiculous.
Yeah,
because I mean, it's a ridiculous.
You did it on your ridiculous orange.
I had an orange P bass with a mirror scratch plate, and I also found a big sparkly M that I stuck on the body. It was like a sticker.
I hate you.
I was going through a phase.
Okay. But you know, we still have in the bass department a snakeskin precision bass scratch plate.
Oh, snake skin on Shoreline Gold.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what else we've got, which I'm almost certain we've got, which would for Telecaster. So you know, more or less, you know,
it probably wouldn't fit.
But you could wrap around it. You know that that corrugated industrial finish. I think
like the stuff that the Offspring had on their.
And there was a James Hetfield
tread plate, I believe.
I'm almost certain that upstairs in our workshop, we've actually got a telly plate. In that finish, that would look awful on that Shoreline Gold guitar
or any guitar.
Yeah.
I guess Matthew, that's our advice. I mean, should we do a vote? Who votes for Tort? People can't see that.
Oh yeah, me.
Okay, and who is for mirror?
Yeah, I think I'll go mirror.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. So mirror wins, hands down. Matthew, get a mirror plate. I don't have any advice as to where you could get one, but I think your best bet.
Parts.
I don't think they'll do one. I think the only way you'll get one is to buy a blank and then have someone cut it into the right shape for you.
Which Graham could do.
Oh, of course, because it's Cabernita, so it's the Gretsch.
Yeah, so what I would do is. Drop one of us an email, probably Jay, and we can order you a blank and we'll get it cut for Cabernita.
And then you will send us 10 pictures so that we can see it from every angle.
Yes, I think that would make my year, actually.
I think
someone put a mirror scratch plate on their guitar under our advice.
Yeah, Matthew's actually a really long time podcast listener. I think he might have been listening from the first one.
Wow.
So yes, we are. Yeah, we'll do it. Whatever you want us to do, mate, just give us a shout. Let me know. Send me an email or something.
If you've got any questions, please do get in touch. podcast@gak.co.uk. Or you can get in touch on Twitter, which I'm man, which is @gak_co_UK. Or on Facebook, facebook.com/gakmusic. If you want to get in touch with me personally, you can @mark_random on Twitter. Please get in touch. This week I've been posting guitar photos a bit, actually, which
Have
is
you?
Weird because I don't normally talk that much about guitars on there. I've been I did a gig last week. I used the most excellent 1980s PV-TNT combo and I posted a beautiful picture of that. Sounded phenomenal. If you're also an 80s PV user, please do get in touch because those amps are some of the best ever made. Jay Cross, how can people get in touch with you?
You can send me an email. It's right, I've worked my way through the 300 emails that I had at the start of the week, so I'm back on a clean slate. You can shoot me an email at j.cross@gak.co.uk or the tweet at me at jbm1, J-A-Y-B-M-1. I'm mainly just sort of talking about my Mustang at the moment. And that's kind of... Well, that probably would have died down, but it'll be football next week, so you know.
Joe Branton, how can people get in touch?
Yes, you can bung me an email on joe.branton@gak.co.uk, or if you want to tweet me, you can tweet me @Yosef_900.
Do you want to repeat that, just in case Billy missed it the first couple of times?
If Billy Sheehan wants to tweet me, or if anyone wants to tweet me about Billy Sheehan, I might just tweet Billy Sheehan again. He's got to reply at some point.
Well, he knows about the podcast now, so...
Well, yeah, exactly, Billy.
Well, and Joe's already following you, so you just need to follow and then you can DM each other.
Yes, that would be ideal. So this week I'm mostly going to be talking about Yamaha BBs.
Again?
Billy Sheehan was the reason I took up the Yamaha BB.
That's true.
I'll probably talk a bit about that.
And if you want to get in touch with regular guest Matthew Knight, he's at Matt_Knightse. That's Knight with S-I-E on the end. I'm sure he'll be talking about his brand new the guitar that he's just bought, 1971 yep. Telecaster.
Was it 71? I thought it was 76.
No, 71. Oh, and goodness. It's an absolute beaut. Yeah. One owner.
It looks all amazing. I have to get in that I told Matt about this, and he is scraping together the money from what he has left after parting with the 71. I found a Boss Spectrum today.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, one of the pedals, yeah.
Very so, nice.
Matt's going to be getting that.
SP1.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And also, one last note. We really, really still want to set up a Google Hangout where we... kind of chat to some of you guys live, and I guess we'll record it either through YouTube or just capture the audio and we'll put it out as a podcast. If you want to get in touch with that, please do email podcast@gak.co.uk. Right, next week we're talking 70s, 80s and 90s. We'll do some more staff picks, and Kevin will get round to answering your question about Neil Young. Thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. It looks like fish food and tastes a bit like cheese. That's the end.